Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome or welcome back to Season 3 of the Logical Christian Podcast. I'm your Logical Christian, Dan Irwin. The Logical Christian Podcast is not here to tell you what to think. It's an exercise in how to think. Rather than just accept what we're being told with regard to current events, politics, science, religion, and everything else, we're going to stop the spin, ask questions, dive deep, and look at the world logically. And since logic is a gift from God, most importantly, we're going to look at it all as Christians. Links can be found in the show notes if you'd like to follow along. So with that, let's go be logical Christians. I'm likely alone on this, and that's fine. I'm willing to stand on this hill all by my lonesome self. But here's what I think. The world is nuts. Now I know, you're scratching your head trying to figure out why I would say that. After all, if you just complain enough, scream enough, activism enough, threaten and bully enough, and manipulate data as well as logic enough, well, everything is literally possibly true. And since my truth is literally true, who are you to say I'm wrong? All makes sense if you force it to. On today's episode, first we're going to learn why you're possibly psycho, even if you're not. Then we're going to make right one of the most brutal periods ever in all of Earth's history. And then we're going to wonder what in the world these guys were thinking. So, strap in, get ready to shake and bake. Grab a box of tissues and don't be afraid to openly weep. And I'm gonna need everyone just to take a few steps back from Mr. Cora. A little farther. Good. Now, as ludicrous as this sounds, here we go. For the last few years, we've been in an almost constant process of being told that everything we used to not even give a second thought is now bad and wrong. Acting, being an actor is bad unless you're acting exactly as the person you are. You don't even try to be someone you aren't as an actor. Enjoying other cultures is now just cultural appropriation. Baseball has the injured list now, not the disabled list, because saying disabled list is insensitive to disabled people. In fact, you can't say disabled people. It's people with disabilities now, because we're supposed to put the fact that the person is a person first, because that defines them, not their disability. Now, I don't know about you, but I never looked at a disabled person and said, look at that disabled entity, which is also a human. We must be proud and celebrate individually and constantly the diversity of everyone, but not males, not whites, definitely not white males. Those groups aren't a diversity or a group. They're barely human. We've had to remove certain episodes of past TV shows because they were too insensitive. Can't have a Confederate flag or the General Lee because flags are racist, and we can't have statues unless they're demonic things like they put in New York a year ago. We can't call a male if he or they or she or whatever doesn't want to be. Same for females. And we must now use literally any and every word to describe someone because all words are pronouns now. And lying is the right thing to do. Words are wrong, thoughts are wrong, everything is wrong and bad, and you're a bad person. And today, we're going to add one more thing to the list from an article written by a Karen, which is probably bad for me to say, about a study done by a psychologist, Dr. Karen, found on sciencealert.com, headline, Study Links Preference for Loud Cars to Some Unsurprising Personality Traits. Now let me back up just a bit for those of you who might be wondering why both the author and the good doctor are both named Karen. They aren't. The author is one Rebecca Dyer. The psychologist leading the study is Julie Aitken-Shermer of the University of Western Ontario in Canada, A Karen, and to be honest, I don't know how much of this is really being used anymore, is a woman, even though we can't define that, who is just insufferable. She's the let me speak to your manager, complaining about everything, finding those who enjoy anything, and sucking the joy out completely through a process of nagging and whining and complaining type of person. The male, if that means anything anymore, counterpart to a Karen, is a Ken. Karens are awful, just awful people. Don't be a Karen. And if your name is Karen, very sorry, I didn't make the rule. I'm just a slave to the latest trends. I guess. If your name is Karen, just be yourself, but don't be a you. Just be you, not a you. Anyway, the author is not simply just reporting on this study. She's doing her own little bit of editorializing with her thoughts and feelings as well. Case in point, the headline, which states those who like loud cars have unsurprising personality traits, Well, that's her opinion. That wording doesn't actually appear in the study write-up in any form at all. She starts her article with, quote, "Most of us have experienced the sudden, deafening blare of a car's modified muffler, shattering your tranquility into a million pieces as it speeds past. If you live in a neighborhood where these disruptive sounds are familiar, it probably won't surprise you that research links a desire to own this type of car to higher levels of sadism and psychopathy, and I hate you, I hate you, I never asked to be born." Okay, look, maybe that last little breakdown bit there wasn't in the article. Maybe. So our psychologist decided she hated loud cars, and she decided that if you like them, you must be evil. That was her basic premise. She said, quote, "As these exhaust modifications are both a disturbance to people and animals and are illegal in some jurisdictions, understanding who wants their vehicle to be loud is an interesting research question." Is it Julie, is it? Or are you just a whiny person who wants things done your way, and to think differently than you is the equivalent to literal violence enacted upon your person? I bet it's more of the latter than the former. In fact, looking at her college department profile picture, I mean, ooh, look, you do you, all right? But she looks like she was about to rip the very soul out of the photographer. Take it and hurry up or I'll have you fired. She neglected to run a comb through her hair, it appears, not a bit of makeup, which, I mean, all that's fine, that's her choice, but that's made it up with just an angry scowl on her face. Maybe that's her resting face. No, I shan't give the popular term for that. Or maybe she's just angry all the time. Or maybe she's just particularly angry in this picture. But she definitely looks like someone who would complain about loud cars. I can all but guarantee that she's called the cops on a car or two in her day. So here's her stated premise of her study. Quote, "Although people are familiar with loud automobiles equipped with modified mufflers to increase the volume, it is unclear who is most attracted to these vehicles." Is it? Let's start with men. Men are most attracted. In fact, in general, not entirely, but in general, younger men. I'm not sure about ethnic background, but it seems pretty independent of ethnicity, as I've seen white, black, Asian, Latino, you know, red and yellow, black and white, think loud mufflers, aight. That's pretty bad. And there's a certain type of girl and woman who love them too. Not as many, but they're definitely out there. No, this lady isn't being genuine in her abstract. She has a predetermined conclusion based on her bias, and by golly, by gum, she's gonna prove her theory correct. To perform this study, so-called, she surveyed 529 people, 55% or 289 of which were men, 44% or 234 of which were women, and if you've done your sums correctly, that leaves a percent. Yes, 1% or 6 of which were other, were also included in the study, of course. She calls them all undergraduate business students. But they have a mean age of 18.14 years old. Now, mean means average. The average age of these 529 undergraduate business students is just over 18 years old. That doesn't make a lot of sense to me. Does undergraduate mean something different in Canada, eh? Or do they just have a heavy genius population? Because the study states that the age range is from 16 to 37 years old. So just to make this clear, if you have an average of 18.17 years old, that means for every 37-year-old, you need 8.7 participants who are 16. Bottom line, this psychologist heavily loaded this thing with kids, throwing in a few adults, but even her oldest range isn't really very old. She then tested the participants in two different areas. One she made up completely, one that's been established for, well, not overly long, but at least it wasn't made up by her, you know, practically on the spot. So the first measure was created by her, quote, "to assess an individual's effect towards vehicles and specifically loud cars with modified mufflers." to test how much these mostly kids like cars, and specifically loud cars, she developed a three-question test. Three questions. Just the three are needed. That's correct. Now, what are these three magical questions that are so well-crafted, so amazing, that they can tell her all she needs to know about these kids? Number one, my car is an extension of what makes me a person. Number two, I think loud cars are really cool. Number three, if I could, I would make my car louder with muffler modification. Now, they rank their feelings on these three statements from 1 to 5. 1 is strongly disagree, 2 somewhat disagree, 3 is neither agree or disagree, 4 is somewhat agree, 5 strongly agree. I gotta tell you, I'm not a researcher, not a pollster, not a psychologist, but this is terrible. It's just awful. I mean, she's passing this off as a real study, and you can tell that she was really searching for a specific response and that this was geared towards kids. I mean, when is the last time you had a question that asked you to rank if you thought something was, quote, really cool? So if someone was all about loud cars, the max score they could possibly make in this entire three-question test would be a 15. Just doing the math, that's 5 points times three questions, if you're curious. The minimum score is 3. I'll let you work the math out on that one on your own. The average score for these 529 individuals, mostly kids, was, ready for this? A 6.53. That means that for her magical questions, phrased and geared to get the responses she wanted, didn't get the responses she wanted. The average answer was in the neutral to somewhat disagree range. And yet, trying to salvage her biased, predetermined conclusion that she so desperately wants to be true, she writes, quote, although the mean was relatively low, the maximum score could be 15, 10 of the participants had a scale aggregate score of 15. Okay, so 10 people out of 529, or 2%, really liked cars, and loud cars specifically. And then she gives a bunch of statistical nonsense trying to make a point that just simply isn't there. This didn't work. But don't worry, the second test will rescue her undoubtedly out of the pit that she's now found herself in. This one is one we've spoken of before. Episode 150, the segment entitled The Sin Factor. In that episode, we discussed what's been termed the Dark Triad, which is a fairly short test that's supposed to determine your levels of narcissism, or pride, superiority, lack of empathy, and psychopathy, which is antisocial behavior, selfishness, lack of remorse, and Machiavellianism, which is a fantastic word, which is manipulating and exploiting, having a self-focus. Now, taking this test would reveal your D factor, or your darkness factor. Again, there are a series of statements, and the respondent chooses their response from a scale of 1 being strongly disagree through 5 being strongly agree. If you recall from the past segment, I took the longer and the shorter D factor tests and came out with a result of 1.69 and 1.81 respectively, which isn't perfect, but it is a very low darkness factor. Per their data of over 2 million tests taken at that time of that segment, I was sitting at 9%, meaning 91% of the 2 plus million people were darker than I. Well, for this study, our psychoanalyst used an updated version of the test called the Dark Tetrad. Yep, this test tests the same three aspects, and then it adds in sadism, which is generally defined as deriving pleasure from cruelty. So how did these mostly kids, who really weren't that interested in cars or loud cars, do on this 28-question dark tetrad test? Well, it appears that there are 7 questions for each of the 4 aspects, meaning each aspect has a total score range of 7 to 35, with 21 being completely neutral. So these mostly kids who don't really care about cars or loud cars scored as follows. Machiavellianism, an average score of 24.51. So very slightly manipulative and self-focused. Narcissism, an average score of 21.11, so neutral with regard to pride or superiority. Psychopathy, an average score of 16.22, so not really selfish or antisocial. And sadism, an average score of 18.26, so also not really into cruelty. So these mostly kids who don't really care about cars or loud cars are slightly manipulative and self-focused, and that's about all. Now, what she discovered is that 18-year-olds, on average, are kind of self-focused and manipulative, on average. Please tell me what she discovered in the study, because I could have told her this. I'm actually a little surprised that they weren't more into their cars, although cars today don't really have the same draw they did, you know, 20, 40, 60 or more years ago, for sure. And I'm a little surprised their darkness factor wasn't higher for the four areas. I mean, teens can be little selfish jerks sometimes. And either you are right now, or you will be, or you were. I mean, let's all be honest here. So then she does more statistical blah, 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 because she's got nothing. After crunching the data, she, like some sort of sage, discovered that men like their cars more than women and tend to be a little darker than women. Again, she could have paid me some of the study money. I could have told her this and saved her an incredible amount of time. And I've got a kid a year away from college. I can use money. In the results section of the study, she says that the SD4 results, that's the darkness tetrad 4 thing, all correlate significantly with the made-up car scale that she came up with. She didn't say the made-up part, I said that part. So this is fine. It might have correlated positively or significantly, but her problem is that her study found literally nothing significant. Now, I'm not saying that I didn't find anything significant. I'm saying it literally came out neutral. My feelings on the subject really don't matter at all. The study just arrived at a neutral non-conclusion here. And yet, she said that the significant predictors for wanting a loud car were that you were a man and that you exhibited psychopathy and sadism. Or in layman's terms, you were wild and mean. But again, she's using the term significant pretty loosely, as nothing was significant. Now, in reading her discussion section, the disappointment was palpable that narcissism didn't correlate to the degree that she was hoping, but she may have a solution. Add a few questions to her totally scientific car scale, like asking if they would like to have people notice their car. I mean, so basically she wants to further taint her already tainted study in order to make it say what she wants it to say. She then speculates, which is what she must do because her study concluded that she's nothing but a complaining Karen, which is not what her hypothesis was. Quote, "The lack of a significant predictor weight for narcissism could be because of the relationship between narcissism and empathy. If individuals who chose to operate loud cars do so even if the noise startles or upsets people, and by people she means her, then it may be that those who have loud cars score lower on empathy. Future research may want to examine the possible predictive power of empathy with respect to operating loud cars." I hope that she's not kicking herself too hard for not making the car questions more biased and throwing something manipulative in there about empathy so she could justify her hypothesis about feelings toward loud cars. Not her, it's people's feelings towards loud cars. And hold on, it gets worse. At multiple points in her discussion, she actually leaves her topic of loud cars and veers off onto tenuously related discussions comparing the traits found in the dark tetrad. For instance, and try to follow her logic here, if you will, quote, "The present findings are in agreement," keep that in mind, "the present findings are in agreement," back to her words, "with those reported by Werner et al., 2022, who reported that psychopathy and sadism scores had significant positive correlations with responses to a single item asking if the individual had intentionally started an illegal fire. In contrast, both Machiavellian and narcissism scores did not correlate significantly with the fire-setting question." What does this have to do with anything, you might ask? That's a great question. Nothing. But undeterred by her own incoherent ramblings, she, much like life, finds a way. See, psychopathy can be thought of as being cruel to others, up close and personal. Sadism can be thought of as being mean, wanting to harm people from a distance. How? Don't know. Doesn't matter. See, quote, modifying a muffler to make a car louder is disturbing to pedestrians, other drivers, and animals at a distance, meeting the sadism component, as well as startling when up close at intersections, meeting the psychopathy component. See? Plus, if you like loud cars, I think you want to start fires. I'm not sure how all this works together. And this woman, who I would just bet would say something like, don't judge me, were I to criticize this dog's breakfast of a study, goes on to say, quote, other than legally enforcing laws with respect to these automobile modifications, the present results suggest that other tactics, such as information campaigns, may not be useful, as it is unlikely that those scoring high on psychopathy and sadism would be swayed by the fact that the modified mufflers may be damaging to others, as researchers have recently reported that the dark personality dimensions are negatively correlated with altruism measures. Damaging? It's damaging. What exactly are your damages? How is startled or disturbed for, I mean, in some cases, multiple seconds at a time? How is that damaging? And then her conclusion. Her conclusion starts with this gem, quote, although the present study explains some of the variance in people's favorable attitudes towards cars with loud modified mufflers, jump in here for a second, does it? Her study literally only explains that she's a crybaby who wants things her way. She doesn't like loud cars, so nobody should like loud cars. The statement goes on with, quote, the study is limited in that other loud vehicles were not examined. For example, different results may have occurred if motorcycles or trucks have been the target variable. Size of vehicle may also have had an impact on the results. Larger vehicles are perceived as more aggressive. If both larger and louder car items had been included, the correlations with sadism and psychopathy may have been even greater. Also, it was not examined whether individuals choose to listen to loud music while driving, which has nothing to do with loud mufflers, but she's grasping for something here. As some researchers have reported that listening to hostile music while driving resulted in higher frequencies of violating speed limits in a driving simulator. Which again has nothing to do with loud cars or loud modified mufflers. That's loud music and how it affects your driving. None of this, it doesn't work. None of this works. Quote, in addition, the three items used to generate the car scale were created for the purpose of this pilot study and were not validated with respect to predicting actual ownership of loud cars. Future research may want to examine other loud modified vehicles, how drivers make their cars louder, actual loud car ownership, other antisocial behaviors such as lighting fireworks in a residential area. Oh, this lady's the absolute worst. Socioeconomic factors, as well as other measures of dark personality characteristics and empathy in a more heterogeneous sample. This lady is so angry at everyone and everything. I mean, you can see it on her face and her profile picture. She is just mad at the world because it's not doing what she wants it to do. Back to our article, they note, quote, the participants in the relatively small sample were relatively young and all enrolled in a business degree at the same university, so Shermer's findings may not apply to broader populations. And the kicker is that when you look up her name, this study pops up all over the place. The New York Post headline, do you love your really loud car? Chances are you're a psychopath, colon, study. Jalopnik headline, guys who like loud cars have sadistic, psychopathic tendencies, colon, study. The Street headline, young guys who like loud cars are likely to be psychopaths, study suggests. But the reality is that the study didn't suggest anything of the sort. The psychologist professor who doesn't like her personal peace and quiet bubble disturbed, she suggested that. The study suggests that the correlation between loud cars and dark traits are kind of, meh. Now look, do loud cars annoy me or even on occasion startle me? Sure. And you know what I do? I get over it. I guess if I had a person that was running drags up and down my street, which on my street would be a really odd choice, but go with me here, every night at like 3 a.m, would I call the cops? Probably. If the neighbor had a loud Harley hog and fired up at 5 o'clock every morning to head out to work, would I say something? No, I really wouldn't. And if someone comes flying past me on the freeway, weaving in and out of traffic with the sound of their engine shredding itself to pieces, I pretty much just think that they're kind of being a D-bag and I just move on with my day. So would I like everyone to do things the way I do them or that I'd like them done? Oh, absolutely. That's pretty much everyone's desire. And if you say, no, not really me, well, you're a liar and the truth is not in you. We're all self-centered to varying degrees. What makes this especially Karen-ish is the degree to which she went to try to prove that the people she doesn't like or agree with are psychos. This is unfortunately the selfish world we live in. If given the chance, like say she gets a free pass to do whatever she'd want to, what do you think she'd do to someone who just brap their way past her house? Prison? Torture? Execution? Forced to listen to her tell you about her study? Forced to just listen to her? I think I'm preferring the torture and death, relatively speaking. What we have here is a clear case of absolute selfishness. Just a self-focused, self-centered, horrible person. And this psychologist lady isn't much better. Gotcha, didn't I? So the reality is, this lady is being completely self-absorbed, right? The world revolves around her. At the same time, those with the loud exhaust, listening to loud music, racing through a neighborhood, weaving in and out of freeway traffic, apparently setting fires, well, that person may possibly be selfish as well. And I say maybe because there's some gray area in there and context matters. We could think of this as selfish ambition. As Paul states 4 times in his epistles and James mentions twice rapid fire in his book, this is quite simply elevating yourself above others, but with a slight edge. As Paul and James use it, it has an aggressive, disputing, argumentative tone to it. You're not only placing yourself above others, you're creating an entire psychological study about it, claiming your victim is psychotic. Or you're rolling through an otherwise peaceful neighborhood, music blaring, uncorked exhaust blasting, frightening women and making children cry. In most cases, you can keep your exhaust note down if you ease your way into the throttle. And as I tell my kid, when you pull into the neighborhood, go ahead and cut your volume down by about 95%. No need to be a jerk. And yes, I can hear my dad now. Oh, I seem to remember. And yes, look, my twin 12-inch subs, their counterpart speakers and all the amps. I was a jerk. I cranked the thing up, although in my defense, I did actually turn it down in town, somewhat. The bass just really travels, just far and everywhere. But yeah, I enjoyed my loud music. Yes, I like to see people snap their head around. Put a lot of time and a fair amount of money for a teenager into that sound system. It was there for everyone to enjoy, whether they wanted to or not. But I grew up. Which is what this woman is missing. These mostly children that she polled, they'll grow up. Most of them at least. I mean, some will stay immature forever. But for most of them, whether they're Christians or not, since we inherently know right from wrong and consider it from jerkish, we tend to instinctively follow Paul's admonition and do nothing, or at least not as many things, from a standpoint of selfish ambition, aggressively placing ourselves above others. What I find really troubling is that although most of these very young people will likely grow up and mature, and at least from a human standpoint, be more considerate and less self-focused, the psychologist looks to be getting on in years, but she still at least appears to be fairly immature with respect to placing herself first. She may find it interesting to take the dark tetrad test herself or perform some sort of psychological evaluation on herself and write a paper with her results for all of us to see. back to Paul, as he says in Galatians 5, quote, "The deeds of the flesh are evident, which are sexual immorality, impurity, sensuality, idolatry, sorcery, enmities, strife, jealousy, outbursts of anger, selfish ambition, dissensions, factions, envying, drunkenness, carousing, and things like these, of which I forewarn you, just as I have forewarned you, that those who practice such things will not inherit the kingdom of God." Now, did you catch it? Tucked away in the middle there, in the middle of all those sins, some of them being the big ones, right? Selfishness. The selfishness on the part of inconsiderate car owners and angry Dr. Karens is a deed of the flesh. And although most of us grow out of our totally selfish stage of life eventually, only salvation through Christ can actually address the darkness in our heart and in the heart of the selfish person. At that point, we should start to see our selfish ambitions decrease and the fruit of the Spirit increase. That being love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Now, no. None of us will ever be perfect in this mortal life. Yes, most people will mature, and our selfishness will temper over time. But to really address the heart of the matter, to combat the dark triad or tetrad, to not be a jerk or a Karen or a Ken, to place others ahead of ourselves, to understand and actually care about how your actions might affect others, only salvation through Christ's sacrifice will enable us to make the changes we also desperately need. Pop quiz, hotshot. Some of you will get that reference. The rest of you will have to dig and search and strive to look it up. Don't worry, it's literally the first result on Google. But seriously, pop quiz, what was the first monument recognized nationally by the United States? Do I need to play the Jeopardy music? And no, I don't. It's probably copyrighted and I get thrown into prison or something. Anyway, do you give up now? The Devil's Tower in Wyoming. And what is the Devil's Tower? It's like a big tall rock. I kind of think like a mountain with the top part chopped off and the sides kind of chopped just about straight down. It's interesting looking, I guess, but it's just a big rock. Keep in mind, I'm not an outdoorsman. I'm barely an indoorsman, as in, you know, climbing the stairs feels like I'm scaling a mountain at certain times every day. And why is outdoorsman a word? But Microsoft Word is telling me indoorsman isn't. That seems a tad bit discriminatory to those of us that love to marvel at the wonders of the great indoors. So this segment is not about the Devil's Tower, although that's probably hard to tell at this point. But humor me as I follow this rabbit trail just a bit farther. Why is it called the Devil's Tower? Well, apparently this comes from a mistranslation of the Lakota name for the tower, Matotapila. And I'm positive that's exactly how they say it. The correct translation is Bear Lodge or Bear's Lodge, but when it was translated in the late 1800s, it appears they mistranslated what should have been bear as bad gods. So, using incorrect theology along with their incorrect translation, it became known as the Devil's Tower. But not with an apostrophe, so it's not a tower that's owned by the devil, it's just a tower of devils, I guess. Anyway, per the website of record, Wikipedia, there are 133 protected areas in the United States considered to be national monuments. 35 of them were designated between 1906 and 1925 as the United States, in my opinion, illegally started grabbing up land from the states and marking it as national land. That's another digression that we don't really need to follow right now. But that said, I do want to point out this. Going back to Nixon, here's what we find. Nixon, a Republican, designated 3 in about 5.5 years. That's just over a half of a national monument per year on average. Ford, a Republican, he designated 1, which equates to about 0.4 per year. Carter, a Democrat, did 4. That's 1 per year. Reagan, a Republican, did 4. That's a half per year. H.W. Bush, a Republican, did 2. That was a half per year. Clinton, a Democrat, did 20, including 7 in his last week in office. That's 2.5 per year on average. W. Bush, a Republican, did 7, including 3 in the last month. That's 0.9 per year. Obama, Democrat, well, really a Marxist, he did 28. That's 3.5 per year. And then Trump, a Republican, did 5 or 1.25 per year. And Biden, 5 so far, which is 1.4 per year. My point? Well, the Democrats are the land grabbers. That's what we can really see here. Can't be a socialist or a Marxist country unless you own everything. Am I right? Yeah, I'm right. And digression. I would guess that most of us don't know most of these monuments. They include a lot of natural features, some man-made dwellings and forts, and the first, and in fact the only, statue on the list, the Statue of Liberty, 1924. Now, I went looking for statues, memorials, etc. in the United States, and the reality is that I think there are just way too many of them. I mean, maybe there's a master list somewhere, but my research team and I, my research team, of course, consisting of myself, my keyboard and computer, and DuckDuckGo, or Google, couldn't find it in our extensive researching. Of course, the list of statues is shrinking, not at quite the same rate as the past few years, but the past few years was a fairly dizzying pace of removing monuments and statues of all those racists or perceived racists or people that a group of people today don't happen to like anymore, I don't know, whatever. Literally, there have been hundreds of statues, monuments, and memorials pulled down and either destroyed or put in a warehouse somewhere, you know, way in the back, because it was triggering to people that are literally triggered by anything and everything. Just think of it as a magic eraser furiously scrubbing away our history. But we are replacing them, don't worry. Maybe not at quite the same pace, but we're replacing them. I mean, there's that satanic-looking statue that's a combination of the curly ram-horn devil-demon Baphomet and Ruth Bader Ginsburg that they put in New York City on, I think it was a courthouse, right? And then they also put one in the park. A lot of our new monuments are nothing but pointless abstract garbage at this point. I mean, in my humble opinion. The Simpsons even made fun of that concept a long time ago when Homer was trying to assemble a back patio grill, and because the instructions weren't in English and because he didn't care about the instructions anyway, he snapped and everything got smashed into a mangled mass of parts and concrete, brick, and rage. And for a short time, he became the most highly sought after modern artist of all time. If you do a search, there are an unlimited number of articles that tell us how all of our memorials are wrong, or how they're all great, or which ones we definitely must see, or whatever, and why. Why do we have memorials and monuments and statues and what's not? What's the point? They clearly hold some sort of importance in society. If you remember from a while back when we were looking at the 45 Communist Goals for America, as read into the Congressional Record in 1963... by a Democrat, how many of you said that with me, goals 22 and 23 respectively are, quote, continue discrediting American culture by degrading all forms of artistic expression. An American communist cell was told to, quote, eliminate all good sculpture from parks and buildings, substitute shapeless, awkward, and meaningless forms. And then, quote, control art critics and directors of art museums. Our plan is to promote ugliness, repulsive, meaningless art. And wow, I mean, wow, have we done that? Now, I know I'm not an art guy, never have been, never will be, don't really care, but modern art is trash. I mean, sorry if you disagree, but it really is. In some cases, it literally is. Now, in the Bible, we see various monuments and memorials from very early on. Probably the first that we're told of is the Tower of Babel. As is written in Genesis 11, the people said, quote, come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into heaven, and let us make for ourselves a name, lest we be scattered over the face of the whole earth. This tower, whatever the exact shape or size, had a meaning to the people. It was a monument to themselves. It was celebrating their greatness. It was literally a finger in the eye of God, a monument to their defiance of spreading out and populating the earth. It didn't work out well for them. I think the next memorial we find is in Genesis 28. Jacob in the wilderness placed a stone under his head as a pillow. Kind of glad we've moved past the stone pillow days. And he had his dream where he saw the ladder reaching from earth to heaven and Yahweh affirming his covenant with Jacob. And when Jacob awoke the next morning, he took that stone, set it up as a pillar, poured oil on it, and called it Bethel, which translates to house of God. Beth, coming from the Greek bayith, meaning house, and El, meaning God. We see in Genesis 31 a stone set up as a pillar and a heap of stones set up to signify a covenant between Jacob and Laban. There are multiple places where we see stones being piled or stacked or set up so as to serve as a reminder of something that God had done or a covenant that was made. As the Israelites get into the region of the Promised Land, we see what other civilizations had erected, monuments and memorials, Asherah poles, in order to worship their gods and goddesses. In every case, we see that these memorials and monuments meant something, positive or negative, but they meant something. There was a significance to them. If you think of our major memorials in the United States, the Lincoln Memorial, the Washington Monument, the Vietnam Veterans War Memorial Wall, the Martin Luther King Memorial, Mount Rushmore, the Statue of Liberty, these all have meaning and significance. Even the Confederate memorials had or have, I think still have, meaning and significance. They serve as reminders, or at least they used to before they were ripped down. And this is the problem. Even when the monuments and memorials are abstract nonsense, they were designed and created and are erected with meaning and purpose. They're put in place to commemorate or remember history, or to signify the current or future direction of a nation. And although this article isn't about the United States, it's actually going to be about Canada. And as we've done with Europe for decades, we're following Canada into their depravity as quickly as we can. Where Canada was, that's where we are. Where Canada is, that's where we're heading. So found on NotTheBee.com, headline, Canada is making the first national 2S LGBTQI plus monument in the world, and this is what they decided to build. Now, this is where I first saw this fantastic news, so I'll give them their due props, but we're going to actually go straight to the source on this one. So found on Canada.ca, an article entitled 2S LGBTQI plus National Monument. Now first, can we settle on an acronym for this conglomeration of debauched, perverse lifestyles, please? I'm personally a fan of LGBTQQIA2+, because it just rolls off the tongue. But 2S LGBTQI+, is kind of a mess. Probably doesn't matter, I guess, whatever. The Scrabble bag of letters is as fluid as their alleged sexuality and preferences, I guess. So Canada has settled on a design and location for a large memorial celebrating sinful sexual perversion. Member of Parliament Seamus O'Regan Jr., a good Canadian name, tweeted, quote, Canada will be home to the first national 2S LGBTQI+ monument in the world. No, we won't go back. Well, you will go back. I mean, either the world will figure out the absolute evil of affirming this perversion, or Jesus will handle it when he returns. Eventually, this goes away. Back to the Canadian announcement. Quote, the 2S LGBTQI+ National Monument will memorialize historic discrimination against 2S LGBTQI+ people in Canada, including during the LGBT purge. The purge was a prolonged and widespread campaign led by the Government of Canada to identify and expel thousands of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender members of the Canadian Armed Forces, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and the Federal Public Service. The purge began in the 1950s and continued until the 1990s. The monument will reflect the profound impacts of discrimination experienced by Canada's 2S LGBTQI+ communities, as well as celebrate the achievements of those who fought for equality, educate visitors, and inspire hope and change for the future. Okay. Should we purge those who are LGBT from the military and the police, etc.? I'll be honest. I don't know. I don't know how they did it. But as long as this wasn't a bloody, violent purge, or they weren't locked up like they were for decades in Russia, well, I'm kind of torn. The reality is that this is perverse, unrepentant sin. Now, I believe I've mentioned this before, but my views on the proclivity towards homosexuality has changed over the years. I used to say that it was unequivocally a choice. I don't personally believe it's as easily defined that way anymore. I now tend to think that just as some are born with physical disabilities, some are born with mental disabilities due to glitches in the genetic code as a result of entropy brought about by sin entering the world. This tendency is potentially another mental glitch, an error in the code, if you will. Now, this doesn't make it not sinful. Don't hear me wrong here, as it's not something that must be given into, just as some are more easily addicted to, whatever, pick something, than other people, this may be a lifelong battle that can really only be won, incidentally, through salvation by Christ. But that doesn't mean that it's, just who he or she is and must be. This doesn't mean that we celebrate, normalize, affirm, and most recently deify those with mental illness or addiction. As I've been tagging my social media posts regarding the LGBTQQIA2+ topic as of late, hashtag affirmation is hate. There is absolutely no love in affirming someone who is dealing with dangerous or deadly mental issues. But to the question, should we allow someone who has a mental instability in the armed forces or the police? Personally, I'd say no, but we compromise all over, don't we? Addicted to alcohol? That's fine, as long as it doesn't impede your job. Addicted to drugs? That's a no. Attracted to children? That's a crime, for now. Desiring violent sexual encounters with a willing participant? That's fine. Being violent in a sexual encounter with an unwilling participant? That's a crime. Hooking up with a random whoever? That's fine. Do what you want to do. Purchasing the services of a prostitute? No, that's illegal. See, humanity, generally speaking, doesn't really have a leg to stand on. This doesn't mean we have to live in a theocracy, as I've said many times before, but it doesn't have to mean that we throw out all morals and ethics, just toss them in the wind in the name of freedom and liberty. I think we have the right to say that there are certain mental inclinations that are not allowed in certain positions and roles. I'll admit, I don't know that I have the correct take on this. Your take may be different than mine. It also may be more correct than mine. Bottom line, though, knowing that this is very clearly defined in the Bible as sinful, sexual perversion, regardless of the why, to lust after, to fantasize about it, or to physically participate in it, is sin. Okay, let's go back to the monument, to perversion, before I dig myself a deeper hole and make some of your heads explode. So this monument is apparently a mandatory action that must be taken because of an order from a federal court, which is to be completed next year, 2025. It'll be, quote, prominently located at the northeast side of the intersection of Wellington Street and Portage Bridge, close to the Ottawa River. Centrally located, this site offers views of the judicial precinct, a balance of public visibility and space for contemplation, as well as the ability to host large gatherings. They've really put major thought into how they're going to memorialize this. Okay, the design. Let me tell you, this thing is, wow. All right, they claim that there were 5 teams of, quote, professional artists, landscape architects, and other urban design professionals who competed for a winning design. Out of those invited to participate in submitting their credentials, 5 teams were selected to develop their concept and submit their proposal. These 5 teams, in addition to the members already mentioned, also had, quote, LGBT purge survivors. And with that, I had to look up this purge. So when they say survivors, well, we're not really talking about execution here, or concentration camps, prison, or even really public embarrassment, as they really did this as quietly as possible. We're talking about people who were identified and relieved of duty or fired because of their lifestyle. According to the Canadian Encyclopedia.ca, quote, these characterizations were justified by arguments that people who engaged in same-sex relations suffered from a character weakness and had something to hide because their sexuality was considered a taboo and under certain circumstances was illegal. Okay. And? Now, we may think of this differently today, and by we, I mean society in general, but at the time, that's how it was considered. I'd still say that that it's a character or a mental weakness. Now, jumping to the end of the story, or what should have been the end, in 2017, there was an official public apology issued and a $145 million Canadian compensation package issued. Okay, so survivors were added to the design teams. Now, the 5 teams submitted their concepts. An official jury evaluated them, taking into consideration survey results from those invited to take said surveys, and a winner was chosen. And the winner? Well, I don't know what this is. It's been named Thunderhead. It's supposed to symbolize a Thunderhead cloud, quote, which embodies the strength, activism, and hope of 2S LGBTQI+ communities. So it's a tall cylinder, big, tall cylinder, with openings at the bottom in the general shape of clouds, I guess, with, I don't know, it's just people can kind of wander in there. Maybe a stairway, because it appears there's a platform a little higher up and an observation space cut out of the cylinder. It's kind of like modern art today. It's just terrible. Quote, "It will be a lasting testimony to the courage and humanity of those who were harmed by the LGBT purge, homophobic and transphobic laws and norms and Canada's colonial history. Elements include a sculpture that creates the imprint of a thunderhead cloud and mirrored tile, a pathway through a landscaped park that traces the history of 2S LGBTQI plus people in Canada, and a healing circle ringed with stones hand-picked by Two-Spirit elders. The monument surroundings will allow for large gatherings, performances, and places for quiet reflection." Okay, so this is Canada. This is what they're memorializing. How long before the United States does the same thing? I mean, not for a purge. At least I don't think we ever had a purge, but to be honest, I really have no idea what our government has done anymore. They're definitely nowhere near as innocent as I once naively thought they were. And how far does this concept go? I mean, we all know that the slippery slope isn't real, except for the fact that it's absolutely real at all times in all cases. So knowing that the term pedophile, for example, is now being pushed out of our lexicon, being replaced with minor attracted persons, because they just can't help who or how they are, how long before we have a monument to our inhuman actions taken against these poor, innocent, minor attracted persons? I mean, we've literally thrown them in jail, labeled them as sexual predators, set up police stings and TV shows and probably all sorts of other things. How long before we offer some sort of reparation and monument to their pain to memorialize their survival through the dark times? And this is the problem with a society that's left God and the Bible behind. We see in the Old Testament a constant fluctuation during the time of the judges, and especially the time of the kings, where a generation would tear down the monuments, the high places, the idols and Asherah poles, repent, and turn back to God. Then the next generation puts them all back up again, and then the people are judged by God and oppressed again. And then the next generation, and then the next generation, and the next generation. Now, we've had a few revivals or awakenings in this country. I guess they've had effects on the country, but since we're not a theocracy, rather a constitutional republic, the potential effect on the country is limited at best. It's more personal than it is national. But could we have another awakening and remove the laws, holidays, and celebrations, the de facto monuments and memorials we put in place in this country over the last handful of years, that affirm this perversion as normal, natural, beautiful, and wonderful? I don't know. We can only pray that Yahweh God will have mercy on this country yet again and allow us to come back from the brink. As for Canada, wow, that's a country that needs our prayers desperately. For as bad as we see the United States right now, and make no mistake, the United States is in a lot of trouble right now. Canada is essentially a pagan nation at this point. About 55% of Canadians, claim Christianity, with the majority following Catholicism, which, I mean, that's problematic in its own right. But about 2/3 of Canadians say that religion's influence on the country is waning, with only 29% saying their religion is very important in their life. And 2/3 of Canadians also say that you don't need to believe in God in order to be moral and have good values. So 55% attest to being Christian, which if they read their Bible, they'd know that, quote, "None is righteous, no, not one. No one understands. No one seeks for God. All have turned aside. Together they have become worthless. No one does good. Not even one." But 2/3 say that God isn't necessary to be good. Only 18% claim Protestantism, which when you start kind of mashing all of these percentages together, you start to figure out that Canada is a pagan nation, and the actual legitimate born-again Bible-believing Christians that live there now, well, they're pretty much just missionaries to their own land, a hostile land at that. John Wesley said, quote, "What one generation tolerates, the next generation will embrace." Well, we are way past tolerate. We're currently deep into embrace, and really, we're kind of out the other end of that, where we've normalized what shouldn't be normalized. We've moved into glorifying and really are moving to a point, like I said before, of deifying absolute degenerate perversion, holding up those that embrace the worst of humanity as the best of us, as the truly enlightened ones. So what do? Well, prayer is key. So is knowledge and wisdom. Understand what you believe and why. And we're at a point, we're past the point where we need to speak what we believe. Sometimes the truth hurts, but the truth is the truth. Trying to protect feelings, trying to go along to get along, trying to save our own skin hasn't worked so far, and there's no reason to think it will work in the future, you know, if the definition of insanity holds true. And it does. And let me end the segment by saying this. Elections, they come up every 2 years. We've got one, in fact, in just a few months. Every seat in Congress is up for election every 2 years, and a third of the Senate seats. Every 4 years, we have the chance to vote in or out a president. Although I don't believe government and politics is the ultimate answer, it sure would help if we systematically voted out those who are hostile to moral and ethical behavior and voted in those who more closely represent at least the general principles found in the Bible. And I'm not saying they have to all be Christians, just people who believe along the lines of the major themes in the Bible. And every 2 years, rather than voting in a name, we vote in a person who best represents our worldview. And this I find it to be the most infuriating, is especially true in the red states. We, and I'm assuming that you, most of you at least, are Republicans, we tend to vote in the same Republicans over and over again. You know it's true because they're Republican. Despite the fact that their voting record, their actions, and their beliefs say the exact opposite. Please know who you're voting for. Prayer, growth in knowledge, growth in wisdom, educating yourself, vote like a Christian. Maybe, by God's grace, we can start to tear down the memorials, the monuments, the Asherah poles, if you will, that we've figuratively, and in some cases literally, set up on the high places. And remember to pray for your brothers and sisters in Canada, eh? Oh, they desperately need an awakening there as well. Whoa. Where do you think you're going? Sit down. We ain't done yet. It's time to be Bereans. And God's watching. You don't want to skip the part where we talk about his word, do you? I didn't think so. All right, let me give you my standard disclaimer.
Warning. The following commentary are the thoughts, questions, and revelations, but not in a charismatic sense, of the host of the Logical Christian Podcast. Although the host, as handsome and wise as he is, attempts to do his due diligence in validating these thoughts, questions, and revelations, but not in a charismatic sense, before bringing them to you, the faithful listener, it is possible, although highly implausible, that he may be in error. Please ensure you do your own research. Be Bereans, as it were. Should errors or questions arise, please contact the witty, jovial, practically saint-like host. Please help me. He's making me say this with any and all comments.
Okay, with that out of the way, and I have no idea what he's talking about, I'm making him say that. Hey, let's get to being Bereans. So, when we last met, we were in Numbers 12. Using that as a context clue, applying the logic of mathematics, let's start in Numbers 13. So, God instructs Moses to get a leader from each tribe and send them into the Promised Land to take a look. His exact words, God's exact words, were, quote, "Send out for yourself men so that they may spy out the land of Canaan, which I am going to give to the sons of Israel. You shall send a man from each of their father's tribes, every one a leader among them." That was it. Go take a look at the land that I'm going to give to you. Now Moses chose a representative from each tribe and then told them this, quote, "Go up there into the Negev, then go up into the hill country and see what the land is like and whether the people who live in it are strong or weak, whether they are few or many, and how is the land in which they live? Is it good or bad? And how are the cities in which they live? Are they like open camps or with fortifications? And how is the land? Is it fat or lean? Are there trees in it or not? Make an effort then to get some of the fruit of the land." Why did Moses add so much to the instructions that were given by God? Why did it matter if they were few or many men, if they were strong or weak, if the cities were fortified or if they were open camps? And why would he think that the land would be bad? I mean, it was literally the promised land, right? I mean, maybe I'm reading too much into it, but we always put the failure on the spies for coming back with a scary report. Remember, 10 were bad and 2 were good. But what if Moses told them to go take a look, report what they see, without leading them down the train of thought he clearly led them down? What if he just repeated God's direct order? He knew it. He wrote it as a quote in the book of Numbers. What if he said, Yahweh is giving us this land, of that, there's no doubt. So there's no reason to think that that won't come true. The land will be good as it's the land promised to us by Yahweh, and Yahweh wants you 12 men to go into the land and come report back the wonders of this promised land. It seems to me that Moses was either innocently trying to be too thorough in giving his instructions, you know, kind of treating them like children who could never possibly think about what to look for, or that Moses was worried about what they might be facing shortly. Now, I point this out because, to be honest, I never really noticed how Moses changed up the instruction given by God and how that error is similar to what Eve did with the instruction given by God to not eat the fruit. He never said not to touch it. Or what cults like Mormonism or Jehovah's Witnesses do by adding to Scripture, or like a lot of today's evangelical churches are doing. Rather than just exegeting Scripture, reading it for what it says, they're trying to find something new and fresh and revelatory to try to grab the attention of the congregants. All we're told to do, all we're called to do, is to listen to God through the reading of His Word and do what He says. Okay, next. Chapter 14, we see the result of this, and the first few verses are kind of illogical on the part of the Israelites. Now, the whole of the people wept all night because they knew they were going to die if they went into the land promised to them by God. So what did they say? Well, because they didn't want to die, they wished that they had died in Egypt or in the wilderness. If they go into the promised land, they'll die and the women and children will be slaves, so it would be better to go back to Egypt where they can all be slaves. They want to return to Egypt, the land that God absolutely undeniably rescued them out of, an oppressive nation, arguably the strongest nation in the world at that time, an army that God destroyed by collapsing the Red Sea on them after these same Israelites walked through it on dry ground, but they'd rather go back to the land that God was clearly strong enough to defeat and rescue them out of, because there's no way that God could be strong enough to deliver the land He promised them. And how often do we do this? How often do I do this? God has promised us so many things simply because we are His elect, His children. But we know better. I mean, yes, He's absolutely delivered us time and time again, but there's no way He could do it this time. I better just rely on myself for this one. Next point, humans are delusional, just generally speaking, I'm pretty sure. In Number 16, we find the account of Korah's rebellion. I'm not going to retell this. You can go read it for yourselves if it's kind of fuzzy in your memory or not in your memory at all. Basic idea is that Korah and some other men decided that maybe the days of Moses and Aaron being supposed leaders of the people was over. Maybe it was time for some fresh blood leading this congregation. It didn't end well. It ended with those who rebelled being swallowed alive into the earth along with their tents and belongings and families and pretty much everything, except that we find out later on the sons of Korah were not consumed. For what reason, we're not told. But after the Israelites witnessing this little attempted coup thing, after watching those that rebelled having their names literally wiped from the earth due to the earth supernaturally splitting open, swallowing everything that had to do with them, and then closing back up again, after all that, we read in Numbers 16:41, quote, "But on the next day, all the congregation of the sons of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, saying, 'You are the ones who have caused the death of the people of Yahweh.'" As the reader, you find yourself thinking, no, please, just shut up. Didn't you just watch Yahweh affirm that rebellion against Moses? It wasn't going to be tolerated. Just please stop. But they didn't stop, and another 14,700 people died from a plague on that day. And it would have been all of them if Moses and Aaron hadn't pleaded with God and then literally stood between the dead and those still living, stopping the plague due to the mercy of God. Okay, as I'm trying to keep these segments a bit shorter than the others, one more you might find interesting and then we'll end. Number 17, we find God settling the issue of who exactly He has chosen to lead His people. So He has Moses get a rod, a staff, from each of the tribes of Israel. On each rod, the name of the tribe should be written, with Aaron's name written on the rod from the tribe of Levi. So now we have 12 rods with 12 names. These are to be put in the tent of meeting in front of the testimony overnight. In the morning, the one rod that sprouted would indicate the choice of Yahweh. The next day, Moses went into the tent of the testimony, and the rod of Aaron had sprouted. It had budded. In fact, it had flowered, and it had ripe almonds on it. So Moses brought out all the rods. Each man took his rod, his dry, dead stick. But God told Moses to place Aaron's rod back before the testimony to be kept as a sign against the rebels to stop the grumbling and stop God having to purge the rebellion from the camp. So arguments could be made that Moses or Aaron swapped the rods, but everyone saw the rod, saw the name written on it. Surely someone would have noticed that it wasn't exactly the same rod. Could be argued that Aaron's rod was right on the edge of blooming anyway, so this wasn't really fair. But I looked up almonds. Almond trees can take anywhere from 5 to 12 years to even start producing almonds. Okay. Almond trees take from 3 to 9 months to go from a bud to a flower. To make the flowers, the buds need to go through a period of cold weather first, but not freezing. Once they flower, those flowers need to be pollinated in order to produce almonds. Then almond fruit, kind of an ugly looking fruit, will grow after the pollination, but it takes from about the spring to maybe July or August for the fruit to actually split open to reveal the actual almond in the shell inside. That's about 4 to 6 months. Then they need to dry, with harvest taking place about 2 months after the fruit splits open. So in one night, God took a dry staff, because, I mean, nobody was going to use a green, pliable, bendy stick as a staff, right? God took a dry staff, and in one night, brought it back to life, put it through a solid year, give or take, of maturation, including the important cold, but not freezing cycle, and pollination. God saying he would cause the rod of the tribe he chose to sprout was an understatement. This account should make you think many things. I'll let you noodle out the significance of God displaying his power in this way on your own, but I'll give you one talking point. It amazes me how Christians will accept this account as a miracle of God. No thought as to the absolute impossibility that a full year or more, plus the various specific requirements, all took place overnight because they simply accept the fact that God is God. But these same Christians will argue that there's no way that God could or maybe would create everything, as clearly stated at the beginning of Genesis, in 6 24-hour days, 6,000 years ago. Either they both can be true or both of them are just made up stories by a people prone to creating myths. If you say God can make the rod give ripe almonds overnight, but not create everything, well, I'm not sure that's a limit you really want to place on God. This also should answer the question of, why does everything look like it's so old then, if it hasn't been millions and billions of years? Well, how did a likely dead rod become a mature almond branch sitting on dry ground? I didn't even mention how much water it takes to grow almonds overnight. Well, because God does what God does, right? Why does creation look old? I'd say because God created a mature creation. How did light get here from so far away? I'd say because God placed the light here when he created the sources of the light. And these same Christians decry supernatural creation in 6 literal days, despite the fact that Genesis 1 clearly states that he did. But not only are they fine with a dead stick being brought back to life, they're fine with various dead people being brought back to life, and a dead Jesus coming back to life, bringing salvation to his children. Putting almonds on a stick, creating all of creation, is nothing compared to God coming in the form of man, willingly allowing himself to be unjustly, brutally murdered, coming back to life, and in doing so, defeating sin and death itself. Like I said earlier, I think humanity is just kind of delusional. But with that, I guess I'll wrap this up. So, put some thought into what's been discussed. Make sure you're putting some thought into what you're reading on a daily or hopefully nearly daily basis. I know the goal is to read your Bible in a year, but let me recommend that reading it for understanding, reading it for increasing knowledge and wisdom, is more important than speed. If you need to slow down a bit in order to comprehend more or to think more or whatever, that's okay. I don't think we get any extra gold stars after our names in heaven if we get through the Bible in exactly a year. So as always, let me know what you think. Now get up, get off your duff, go be a Berean. And with that, sadly, we've reached the end of yet another episode of the Logical Christian Podcast. I feel we've bonded as we've laughed and cried and twisted our faces in incredulity. If you've enjoyed or found value in what you've heard, go on and do all the podcast things. And don't forget to check the show notes for links and contact info. Lawrence J. Peter said, "Against logic, there is no armor like ignorance. Jesus told us that if you abide in my word, you are truly my disciples, and you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." So stay in the word, stay logical, stay faithful, and until next time, God bless.